Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my series for looking at Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is with a piece called Out of Nowhere, which is a part of the Biennale College Cinema Immersive, and it's a virtual reality animated piece that has some light interactive components. And so this is a piece that's looking at climate change and looking at the different impacts of climate change on the world, but also like what kind of rewilding efforts can we do in order to mitigate different aspects of climate change. And so the specific contextual domains that are being explored is that it's looking at the impact of extreme weather events of nature and the impact of those on our homes, as well as our communities and our lives, and are there ways that we could collectively act in order to prevent and preserve nature through this kind of various rewilding activities. And so the first center of gravity is the earth element in terms of the spatial and embodied presence that you get from switching back and forth between the first person point of view and the third person point of view, more of an omniscient kind of tabletop scale. And when you're at that more omniscient scale, you have opportunities to kind of have these light interactions where you might be planting some trees and doing this kind of rewilding. So there's these second center of gravity of the fire element of these light interactions that are kind of serving the overall narrative, but it's not necessarily even emphasizing that all too much because you're mostly like a ghostly character that's bearing witness to this story. As it's unfolding, you kind of see the destruction happening from a first-person perspective, but also seeing the impact of climate change on this specific town and community. And I believe there might have been some voiceover narration. I don't think that there's very much dialogue or other character-driven type of interaction. So most of the story is being told both through this juxtaposition of all these different events relative to each other, as well as maybe some voiceover narration. So some of the major archetypal themes are that there's climate change leading to more and more extreme weather events. So unexpected and catastrophic events that have utter transformative potential to bring about change. Also an account of destruction and the aspects of reality from homes to environments, and a look into the past to prepare for the future. So from the description, it says, quote, "Each one of these events carries stories of personal loss, but also inspiring resilience. If we can come together in the aftermath of a disaster, shouldn't we be able to do so in preparation? So there's various solutions to, quote, give nature back a little room whenever possible for climate-resistant plans. That includes things like rewilding efforts, planting trees at the tabletop diorama scale, and the healthy riverline ecosystems that can help to protect us." So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Chris happened on Sunday, August 31st, 2025 at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
So my name's Chris Hoffman. I have a background in animation and motion design, actually. And then about 5 years ago, when I moved myself from the UK to Austria, I started to focus on designing immersive experiences. And at first, primarily for children and augmented reality. So the piece I have here is actually my very first virtual reality piece, but I have quite a few years of experience with augmented reality, mixed reality.
Great. Maybe you could give a bit more context to your background and your journey into working with immersive media.
I think it started very much with a project. So when I moved from England to Austria, as I said, it was just a time around Brexit, and we had, you know, the big bad election in the US that nobody wants to talk about now. But I got very interested in how do we know what is true and what is not true? How do we distinguish fact from fiction? And I got talking to a curator from the Austrian National Library in Vienna, and I actually thought that augmented reality could be an interesting way to introduce young people who don't usually go to very old established institutions like the Austrian National Library to that place as a place of adventure. So we built a, now you, when we think location-based entertainment, we think of this grand experience, but it's still, I called it back then a site-specific augmented reality experience. And you have these free animated bookworms that guide children through the Austrian National Library and tell them about the space, but also pose questions about how do we know what is true and what is not, and where do we get our knowledge from. And so I think it started with that project that I got interested. It was my first augmented reality piece, and to be honest, I always felt like augmented reality is a quite natural. The animations I was doing were mixed media animations, and augmented reality is a quite natural progression from that, because in a way you're still mixing mediums. No, you're mixing the real world with animated elements, and So it felt natural to me to do that and the right medium for that project. And then I fell in love with AR as a medium, did a couple of more AR pieces, met, in fact, Michel Reilac at Sheffield Dogfest, and he mentioned the Biennale College, which I participated in that, and through that came to my first VR piece.
Yeah, maybe you could share a little bit more about your college Biennale cinema immersive experience.
About the college itself, it was amazing. It's really, really exhausting, but also amazing. So, I mean, I'm not sure how much I should talk about the process itself, but you go there, as you know from previous interviews, with a quite basic idea of what you want to do, which subject you want to tackle. And then people with a lot more experience in immersive storytelling help you shape that story into something that stays true to what you want to say, but is the best possible way to get it across, and also a reasonable way. So we had input from UX designers, from storytellers, but also from like more the production side of things to make it feasible, you know, to help us shape a project towards a budget that would be reasonable within, you know, making a first project, or for me at least. And it was a fantastic experience. I learned a lot, and I then proceeded to get funding for the project, found the co-producer, and spent a year working on it now.
Yeah, so maybe you could take me back to some of the initial spark of an idea for what you wanted to explore in this piece.
Well, I'm, aside from an XR creator, I think of myself also as a bit of an activist in the environmental realm, and I'm interested in ecological themes. That was also a big part of my work as an animator. And as we all know, climate change is making our weather angrier, more extreme. So we have floods and wildfires and droughts, and they're increasing and they're coming closer and closer to us in Europe. And I felt that maybe with an immersive experience, you can bring it closer to home, you know? So it's not something abstract anymore that we as Europeans sometimes think of quite arrogantly, think of it as just happening somewhere else. No, 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 no. It is all happening here now. And it's not something that you just read about in the paper anymore. It's a felt experience. And I thought that maybe with the help of that medium, there'd be a way of linking it to a personal story, this experience of what is it like if extreme weather events, like in my case, in the case of our story, a flood, takes away your home and threatens you, and what it's like to rebuild afterwards, and then link it to the larger ecological themes. Because, I mean, as you know, we tend to connect better to personal stories. So the piece is a personal story, but also a larger environmental story.
Yeah, I think it's over the years, I think it's probably been one of the hardest topics to try to tackle because of the vast nature of climate change and the systemic ways in which that sometimes it could be hard to take that collective phenomena and isolate it down to an individual point in time or a personal story. But I feel like your approach, that what you took to kind of be starting off into this chaos of an aftermath of an event, and then to sort of go backwards and to give the more context as to what's happening. So just curious to hear a little bit about how you were structuring this piece, but also trying to ground it into an embodied experience that would be understandable for people to understand the type of devastation that could happen on one of these extreme weather events.
Gonna try and answer it in two ways. So in terms of the experience itself, I think the key thing for us was to first of all use the flood as an element of surprise, you know. So it's not like that from the get-go, you know, it's like there's going to be a disaster. So you want people to, and I mean, I'm hoping I achieve that, that they feel cozy at first, you know. The world's still the way it should be, you know, especially in a place like Austria. We're a rich country. And then it happens quite sudden. So that was an important element for me. The second part was where we wanted to show the water that is devastated that part of that pretty town and contrast it to a place where the water is supposed to be, which is, you know, in the natural floodplains. That, I mean, I believe that was the core, you know, that it's my piece. I don't see it as like a climate change piece, but as a climate solution piece. And one of the climate solutions that we do have is to give nature back a little bit of room. And this rewilding project, especially around rivers, that is universally true in Europe, in North America, everywhere, that would help protect us. And I think that's what I really wanted to focus on, you know, to tell people there is, like you said, it's an overwhelming issue that you focus on that one part. This is something that we can do that help protect us from the consequences of climate change, so not to avoid it. And that was, for me, one of the key moments in the project, that you want to show the water, the excess water that comes during a flood, has a place where it can expand and where it can go when you give nature room. And that is kind of the contrast that we were trying to build, you know, with here it is where not supposed to be and here it is where it's supposed to be.
Yeah, maybe you could step through the different scenes that you wanted to take people on in terms of like the story that you're telling, and then just to help refresh my memory in terms of each of the beats of the story, because I have like sort of memories of like montage sequences and like the devastation, the flood, but yeah, I'm just trying to remember the exact sort of sequence of everything.
Well, you start off, the experience is framed by two bird's eye view scenes, you know. So before you are properly immersed, you have like these dioramas. The first, you start off with a diorama of the specific place that our main character, Anna, where she grew up in. And it's actually a small town in Austria called Hallein. It's really beautiful, very, very old town. And we see that town develop over time. And one of the reasons why I decided to place the story there, apart from a personal connection, because, you know, I used to visit that place a lot, I have friends there, was also because when you try and communicate that message, is so often, you know, it becomes politicized. You go like, oh, but you just want to rip down our towns. No. That's not what it's about, you know. I completely understand that towns have grown naturally over time, and that, you know, back then when towns were built, especially these old European towns, there was a reason to tame rivers. You know, you had to do that. You know, there is nothing bad associated with that. So I picked an old town that you can say they've grown naturally. It's nobody, you know, we don't blame anybody. So you start off with seeing this town develop on a diorama world, and you kind of slowly focus in on her personal story, on Anna's story, where she tells you that she's grown up there, she's married there, she was a teacher there, she's raised her children there. And fairly suddenly, over a short period of time, the mood changes, because then she starts to take us back to the day in June 2021 when a flood devastated her hometown and her home. And then you basically ripped out of the diorama third-person perspective and placed into her front room, which is flooded. And this is all a true story. This really happened. And basically what happened is that, because through a stupid incident with her opening the wrong door, water comes in and starts to fill up the room, and the pressure that builds, she was unable to open it anymore. And that's kind of a scene we tried to recreate. We just rebuilt the scene, you know. We tried to, I mean, it's an artistic interpretation of the square and of her home, you know, the hand-painted texture. So it's not a, just to refresh your memory of the look of it, it's a very, I come from 2D animation, so even though it's a CG piece, I've painted it all by hand, but it's inspired by the real space. And then we go basically out of, you know, we stay immersed in the full-scale world. We go out to the place, you know, from her home to Hallein, and then contrast that with an alluvial forest, a riparian forest, where the water is supposed to be, and which is also like a haven of biodiversity. And then framed again from that, you go back out into a little diorama where you get a chance to interact with the world. And by gently placing your hands over the diorama, you can avoid the trees and this natural environment around the river being cut down. So you can grow little trees right at the end of it. But I think, you know, the collage montage piece, you remember, that's right at the end where we just added that before the credits to anchor it in reality, because this really happened. And as I said, my piece is very like a handmade fantasy world, and I felt that was important to say no, this has really happened. And
yeah, you kind of see footage of a lot of floods coming in and cars moving down the streets, and within the VR experience you see the aftermath of some of that from a first person perspective. And you get more context as time goes on to see that yeah, it is something that's grounded in the video evidence of some of these extreme floods that are happening due to climate change. And so I'm just curious to hear some reflections on switching between the third person and the first person, being able to actually be on the ground and have this kind of first person perspective onto the story is something that is somewhat unique in the sense of, I guess you can do that in film as well, but I guess it feels different when you're immersed into a place. And so just curious to hear a little reflection of, you know, moving beyond what previous media have been able to do with the 2D frame and what VR really affords to give people kind of more of a visceral embodied experience of that.
But that's exactly why also we decided we can afford to work without the main character being visible. Because you're being put into the shoes of our main character, Anna, as I mentioned. And we try to work with little tricks before, right at the beginning of the experience. There are small interactions that when she talks about her experience as a child, she talks about that water is kind of the thread throughout the experience. Every scene has water in some way. And right at the beginning, you're invited to put these little origami boats into the river like Anna used to do, and we try to find ways how to make sure to give the person in the experience the connection with our main character. So we built the water inside the experience reflects Anna's face back to you, and that happens. You have that in three of the experience. You can see your own reflection, or I mean the reflection of Anna. I mean, this was actually an idea of the writer that I worked with, Ira Wedel, a writer from Germany. I enjoyed that collaboration enormously, and that was her idea. She kept saying, okay, if you want to use that medium to put the user into the shoes of Anna, how do they know that they are Anna? And so that's why we tried to work with that reflection to give people the opportunity to identify with Anna a lot more. Because then, you know, again, in the room and in the forest, you are her. And I guess that's something that, I mean, I always think a good book is closer to VR than a film. Because often, you know, when a book is written in the first person, you know, that's how you really immerse yourself in the story of that person. And to an extent, I hope did that. But I mean, this was the big question for us at the beginning was always, do we have a character, Anna, that you watch, or are you Anna? And in the end, we decided that's something that only VR can do, to give you the opportunity to be Anna. So that's what we decided to do.
Yeah, and from this top-down diorama scenes, my recollection was that you're almost like waving your hand over the diorama, and then as you're doing that, then there's like trees that are growing. So it's sort of like a idea of remediation, but sometimes the trees would disappear and I would do it again. And so just trying to get a sense of what message you were trying to get and adding that level of interactivity to the diorama in terms of the overall themes of the story.
Well, like you said, you know, you have to keep doing it, you know, and that was actually a deliberate thing because it's not easy, you know. I mean, everything you want to do, even though it's a small of it's one part of a very complex solution, but it's something you can do, and it's also very satisfying to get involved in climate solutions that you can see an immediate effect, or an immediate effect, but I mean it's over a few years. But it's still, even though these small ones, you have to work for them. So even when we tried it, you know, and you put your hands over that diorama and the trees grow and then they just stay, it's a bit like it didn't create that feeling that you have to work for it, you know. So we wanted to do it. I mean, I hope we managed to find a balance between doing it a few times and not too much. You know, so it gets annoying. You have to have some level of satisfaction in there. You know, okay, so now the trees stay, but I wanted it. You have to do it a couple of times to keep at it. You know, that was kind of the message that we are trying to say, and also that I put it right at the end because I felt it was important to convey to people that you can have an impact. You know, it's not all, I mean, this is for me as an activist really important. There's nothing more depressing than when you constantly hear about climate change and all the problems that are facing the planet and you feel helpless. But that's actually not true, you know. And floods are actually, I think, a great way to see that when communities are devastated by floods, they often come together in the aftermath to rebuild, and you get this like strong community feeling, you know, that we are doing this together, we get, you know, people help each other. And I do wonder if we do that in the aftermath of a flood, shouldn't we be able to do it when we prepare ourselves from them? And that's actually something these rewilding projects, they rely heavily on community participation, on community support, on bipartisan support. You know, it's just, it would be really important that we drag environmental issues out of this left-right divide and just pull together. So it was really important to me to right at the end convey to people there is something you can do, and that's why we added this interactive element.
Yeah, and I'm also trying to recall there were some potential scenes of the river kind of bending, and yeah, so I'm just trying to remember what that scene was.
Yeah, you're right. It was right at the first diorama, you know, what I mentioned before, we picked that place as a setting for the experience, not just because of my personal connection, because it's an old town. And one of the things that we've, as a society, have done over the last 100 or so years extensively is push rivers into confined pathways, which, like I said, it was necessary, you know, because rivers were important industrial roads in a way, you know, back in the time, especially the town I picked, Hallein, it was an important place for salt production, you know. And so anyway, more and more we've taken rivers, the natural riverbeds away and confined rivers and straightened them. And that's actually something, a big part of rewilding efforts is, it's got this funny word of re-wiggling rivers, that you give them back the natural flow. That's not something that is in the experience, but when you see the town that Anna grew up in and lived in and then was hit by the flood, when you see that town develop over a period of time, you also see the river, how it's changed, how it went from, you know, a wild place with lots of sidearms to essentially like a straight line. And that's something man-made that doesn't help floods now. And I'm not saying that, especially when rivers run through towns, you can't change that anymore. You know, you can take people's homes away. But outside of big towns, it'd be really important to do that. And actually, there is some really interesting initiatives in Holland or in my home state of Austria where this is already happening, where stretches of river outside of big towns are given back some of their natural flow.
Yeah, and I think another takeaway that I had from this piece after watching it was, it was sort of a visceral embodied experience of the reality of climate change, and coming from a American United States context, then there's still a lot of people that are like denying that climate change is even a thing. And so I guess I'm sort of left with this being in a weird place where the United States political context is that they're turning a blind eye or even denying that this is a reality. And so, but it sort of gives this sort of helplessness of like, okay, yeah, I watched this experience, I know this is true, but gets back to this deeper issue that you were talking about earlier, what's truth, what's reality, and navigating that. So just curious, because that was something that you had mentioned earlier, what's true, what's not true. How do we create like a shared consensus reality or a way of navigating epistemology in a collective level, of establishing knowledge of what's true or not true? Seems to be polluted by a political process, and it feels like this experience could be a bit of like, okay, grounding in the reality of the truth that is happening. The causes are still debated, obviously, like people are still questioning whether or not climate change is even a thing. But yeah, just curious to hear some of your thoughts on where this piece sits in that larger context, but also like, where is the agency for individuals in the context of this larger war over the truth?
I mean, I guess one of the very deliberate decisions that we've made in the piece is not at all to explain why extreme weather is happening, why we're in this situation, because as you said, it's a heavily politicized subject for some other reasons that I don't understand, but it is happening. And I think we live in the world as it is, not as we want it. And in that context, I almost decided, okay, let's focus on the extreme weather and not about, you know, there is, I think, one quote we put in right at the end that it is an undisputed scientific fact that climate change is the cause for that. But no matter what the cause for it, it is happening. So our piece is very much not about why it's happening, but one of our ways out of it. And I'm hoping that this is maybe something we can more easily find common ground over, you know, that, okay, people from all across the spectrum suffer from these extreme weather events. So instead of allowing this political debate to rage, just focus on how we get out of that. And that was, for me, why I picked that. Also because it's more satisfying for people, you know, to give them a solution rather than bang on about a problem.
And how do we get out of it?
Yeah.
Okay. If I would have the answer to that, I wouldn't be an XR creator. I'd be running for president, I think. But I mean, in the context of there is a wonderful book actually that made me feel better. It's called Not the End of the World by a scientist from Oxford who runs, Hannah Ritchie, who runs a fantastic website called Our World in Data. And she basically says, you know, the data says and the research says we have the solutions to get out of there. We just have to invest in them. So it's all there. I mean, there's obviously big political efforts and financial efforts being made that these efforts don't succeed. But they are there, you know, we have the solutions, and rewilding is one of the many solutions we have to get us to a better place.
Okay, so it sounds like in the piece itself, you're sort of pointing to some of these different solutions and just...
I think, you know, my piece, I think maybe for context, it's 10 minutes, you know, you can't tackle so much, you can only tackle so much in 10 minutes, so... I decided to focus on one thing, and the one thing we focus on is rewilding efforts as a way to protect ourselves from floods. And of course, with, you know, there is much larger questions to be answered, and with regards to other extreme weather events, you need different solutions, but that is the one thing we focused on, especially because it's so easy, it's so here already, you know. In fact, like I said before, you know, these efforts are already happening. Very recently, our project is a German-Austrian co-production, and very recently, Bavaria and Salzburg, which is a state in Austria, together they fund rewilding efforts along the very river that our project is set. So these initiatives, I mean, they're still too few and far in between, but they are happening, and it's very satisfying to go find them and support them.
And then how did you come across this as a topic or a research? It sounds like, you know, there's a lot of research that you've done into this area. So I'm just curious the catalyst for you to start to dig into this as a topic.
You know, I mentioned before that I moved from Great Britain to Austria in a time of political upheaval. And I guess, you know, going back to what you said before, you know, it's, I was always so annoyed that we are still debating what is fact and what is not around even climate change and all sorts of other issues. And when I was in Great Britain, I got very frustrated that I can't be politically active, or only to a certain extent. You know, we had the Brexit vote, and I lived in England for 15 years and I wasn't able to vote on it. You know, it made me really frustrated. And then when I moved to Austria, suddenly I felt, okay, I have more agency as an activist here because that's my nationality. So I got involved in initiatives around climate change. So that follows through my work, not just in XR, but everything else.
And have you seen XR being used in other contexts around this topic of climate change and the different circles that you're looking at in terms of these larger issues and activist circles?
Yes, but you know what? I sometimes felt not to the extent that I thought was really, really effective, because I think in the XR space, there's been, I mean, I've seen some really powerful pieces around mental health, around sexuality, and often with climate change and environmental issues, it lacks like the personal connection, you know, it's always a lot of the time, to me anyway, you know, it's very data heavy, which, and I can, you know, I'm interested in that, but I think VR is such a powerful medium, if we manage to deal with distribution issues, such a powerful medium to change people's minds, and then you have to collect people where they are, you know, and that is not just, we want to just be full of data. They need personal stories to connect with, and that brings us back to why I chose a personal story.
Yeah, I'm remembering some other pieces that have been around climate change. Well, there'll be like a 360 video shot in Antarctica with like ice that's melting, and that it's like a couple of steps removed from, you know, you see the impact of the melting glaciers that they were kind of showing a 360 video and the audio, but again, it's sort of like disconnected from a personal story. It's very abstract.
Also from your lived experience, because this is like something we talk about all the time in my circle of friends, that the ice bear, you know, I feel sorry for the ice bear. It's beautiful, majestic animal whose natural habitat were taken away, but it's far away. And that's just not the truth anymore, you know. Climate change and these extreme weather events, they're hitting us where we live, you know, in all all across the planet. And I know that, of course, the Global South is obviously at the forefront of being hit the hardest, thanks to us, but it's everywhere, you know, and this is kind of what we need to, I think, communicate, you know, that it's not just in the Arctic and far away, it's hitting in Europe and in the United States and all where we live.
Yeah, and I think by having it in like a context of a home or a community or a neighborhood that you see the virtualized impacts of one of these extreme weather events. And, you know, I guess we all have our own experience of home or our communities or our neighborhoods. And so I think it makes it less abstract and much more concrete to have that within a VR that we can project ourselves into it a lot easier.
Yeah, you put that beautifully. I don't have anything to add to that. That's kind of what we wanted to do, you know, make it less abstract, because that's a lot of the time what happens. You know, you have these wonderful graphs that show you how our, you know, the temperatures are rising, can be impactful, but it's a graph, you know, and like you said, the aim is to make it less abstract.
Great. And finally, what do you think is the ultimate potential of virtual reality and immersive storytelling, and what it might be able to enable?
We hope to change people's minds. That's kind of what we hope to do, but we've got to tackle the distribution issue first, because I think that's, for me at least, as a next step, it'd be really important to break out of the bubble that you show it to people who come to see it because they're interested in VR, you know. I think it could have a lot of impact on people who you want to reach because of the subject matter, but not because they come to see something that is VR. And we just got to figure out how to do that still. But I think if we tackle that well, and I mean, there's even here, I saw some interesting panels talking about just that, then it's got huge potential, I think, to change people's minds. Because so many times when you're in a conversation, which, you know, I'm not one to give up easily, you know, I have these arguments with people and debates. I try to allow myself to have debates with people who come, you know, have very different views. I think it's really important. But it happens so often that, you know, you just want to win the argument then. You don't listen to people. And I think VR has enormous potential, because then you don't get combative, you know. You just allow people, like a good book, you know, you allow people to experience something. Like there's nothing more powerful than a good book that puts you in the shoes of somebody in a different place of the planet with a, you know, where you see, okay, they live and have a very different experience, but essentially the emotions are very close to mine. And I'm hoping that VR could do the same at some point.
Yeah, we have a few minutes left. I don't know if there was any questions you had, or you said you wanted to turn the tables on me. And if you didn't know if you had any things that you wanted to bring up or discuss.
Well, why not, actually, you know, especially because we're already talking about, you know, ecological storytelling. Do you feel, you know, the question that you asked me before, that it could have an impact, and where do we need to improve if we want to tell these ecological stories and change people's minds? If this is the goal, where do we need to work on? What do we need to work on?
No, I think the thing that I think really works is to make it personal in the way that people can project themselves into. And I think the challenge with the ecological stories has been so abstract or disconnected from people's immediate experiences. And so I think this strategy of extreme weather events, there is a saying of, I forget who said it, but it goes something along the lines of like, the experience of climate change is like watching these extreme events happen around the world until you're the one who's taking the video. And there's something around that, like, way that the thing that seems far away is suddenly like in your backyard or right in front of you, and that you're the one who's documenting it. I don't know. There's something powerful about that for me that just sort of hits my heart. But yeah, I mean, it's, again, it's such a politicized topic that coming out of a context of like a broken democracy where things aren't like functioning in a way that like the oil industry and everything else has kind of like hijacked all the mechanisms of political action. But obviously the United States isn't the only country in the world, and so I feel like there's leadership opportunities for places outside of the United States. And I don't know, it feels like it's one of these topics where one of the brilliant things about VR is that it can connect the dots between things that are hidden or not seen and make them seen. And so ways of making it clear that small actions can aggregate up into big actions collectively, but also sometimes those big or small actions are done by the top 5 or 1% of the people who are doing the most damage, and it's like getting them to change. And so it then becomes more around how you, again, more of a political or economic regulation or controlling the worst offenders. But, you know, there could be a way that there's a, I like to think that there's a way to get like a collective action to get people to really move. It just, it's hard for me to have a theory of change that sees how that has happened in the past to then extrapolate how that's going to happen in this specific context. And so it's sort of like getting out of the escapism, addictive qualities of people looking at their phones and getting them to actually like pay attention to care about something and take action. And closing that gap is something that I don't have a solution. And if I did, I would be probably working on it.
We'd be running for parliament together if it have these solutions. But yeah, I agree. But you know what? I actually think that environmental issues, more so than others, there are an opportunity to get people on board from a broad spectrum of society. I mean, I don't know, Austria, where I come from, just like Britain, we all care about the environment. You know, it's just a matter of framing it, because I so much love this word game of conserving something. You know, conserving something should also mean you conserve the environment. No, so I do hope that when you don't approach, you know, when you go away a little bit from the climate change topic, but you go more on ecological issues and saving our forests, we could build bridges, and maybe VR can help with that.
Did you have a chance to go to the architecture Biennale at all?
No, unfortunately not. But I've heard it's supposed to be very good, and there's a lot of sustainability themes there.
Yeah, I mean, I had to kind of zip through it because I had to get to the Wayne McGregor like show, and I only had like an hour, and then ahead of time, and maybe a half hour afterwards. But there were quite a lot of like architectural design things around sustainability that I think it was, like you said, a lot of the solutions are there. It's just a matter of adopting them. And then William Gibson had the quote of saying, "The future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed." This concept of like the solutions are there, they just haven't been implemented in a way that are at scale. And so I don't know, I feel like that going to something like that and seeing the other solutions and other kind of innovative ways of being more in right relationship to the world around us, I actually think it's kind of like it gets back to like a deeper philosophical shift of like getting away from treating things as separated objects and really focusing on the interrelatedness of it. It's like a deeper philosophical paradigm shift that I think from that shift of relationality and being in right relationship to the world around us, like so much other things can grow around that. And so that's something that I'm thinking a lot around is like, what are the things that are going to really catalyze this shift out of like thinking that we're these isolated islands unto their own right, but to really see how we're all interconnected and we're all in relationship to the world around us and how to really be in right relationship to the world rather than in a extractive or destructive relationship. And it's that type of philosophy, values that drives the economy and the laws that get formed from the companies buying out the politicians. And so, yeah, I feel like at the core root, I feel like that's the unlock, that if that could happen, then there's so much more that could come from that.
Couldn't agree with you more. I did the piece I did is also with a children audience in mind, an augmented reality piece I did before. This one is called Insects and Us, that is all about our relationship with insects and how we depend on them to make the world go round, essentially. And, you know, with insect decline as part of the biodiversity crisis, and one of the key issues we try to focus on there is that we as humans are not either the great destroyer or great protector. We are part of this delicate ecosystem, and that if we take puzzle pieces, you know, at the moment it's like an entomologist I worked with, she described it as this big net, you know, and you can untie a few knots of the net and it'd be fine, and we're still sitting in it. But the more knots you untie, the more it gets loose and we might crash onto the floor. But that is, I completely agree with you, we need to see ourselves as part of that and not as outsiders looking in, either with good or bad intentions.
I think we just solved it.
Yes.
I think our work is done here.
Our work is done. We can run for parliament now.
Is there anything else that's left unsaid you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Thanks for chatting to me, and I was very much enjoying my time here.
Awesome. Well, Chris, thanks so much for talking a little bit about Out of Nowhere, this piece that is trying to give this direct embodied experience and personalize something that can be very abstract. And yeah, I think that telling a larger story of climate change, and I think that it's not an easy task to do, and I think you were able to kind of land in a place that makes it like a visceral, embodied, personalized experience that we can project ourselves into. And yeah, just really enjoyed the piece and enjoyed having a chance to break it all down. So thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage. And hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.